Lecture 19, The Pan-Hellenic Dream.
Welcome back. With our last lecture, we saw the resurgence of Athens as a great naval power, thanks to, ironically, Persian support. Now, if your head is beginning to ache from all these reversals in the Greek world, you are not alone. The Greeks themselves were dismayed by the inability of the city-states of Greece, Athens, Sparta, Corinth, Thebes, and the others, to create a stable world. And that's going to be the theme of our lecture this time, is this quest for a Pan-Hellenic, a Greek-wide mission, a sense of unity that so far has been lacking in Greek affairs. However, we're going to start, pick up the story with the coming back to the light of the Athenian navy, Conon's rebuilding of the Long Walls, and the situation there in the late 390s, as Athens once again resumes its sort of imperial mission at sea. Well, of course, no sooner do the Athenians get their navy back than what do? That old mission to liberate the Greek cities of Asia comes back into their minds. Most of those cities are still now in the hands of the great king, one of the results of the fall of Athens in 404 BC, and the payment of the Spartan war debt, as it were, to Persia, was the handing over of Greek cities in Asia to the king. Many of them have not yet been liberated, and so the Athenians start fighting the Persians. This may seem like a great betrayal, after all the help that the king Artaxerxes gave to the Athenian Conon, but remember, that was using Conon for his own purposes. Athens, as a city-state, felt no obligation or debt to Artaxerxes for what he'd done. And they set about first supporting a rebellion against the Persians on Cyprus itself, and then making war to get the Hellespont on both shores, Asiatic and European, back into Athenian hands, and even go around to that site where Cimon, back in the 460s BC, won the great battle of the Eurymedon River against the Persians on land and sea. An Athenian general named Rasibulus, a radical democrat, takes the Athenian fleet there and is actually killed in action by local tribes as he's trying to extend Athenian influence further and further into Persian territory. This was symptomatic of the years, approximately 6 years, that followed the great victory at Cnidos and the reversal of Spartan hegemony at sea. It is a chaotic time where Athens and Sparta are both vying for the leadership of Greece, and Persia is still feeling injured by whoever is the leading Greek state. Eventually, the Spartans begin to fear, if we don't somehow put a check on Athenian expansion, we will be right back where we were before we seemingly beat them at the end of the Peloponnesian War. So a Spartan diplomat named Antalcidas, who seems to have had a way with getting along with Persians, went over to Asia Minor. And he presented himself to one of the satraps, a man named Tiribazos, who we last encountered on the banks of a river with his army, trying to prevent Xenophon and the 10,000 from wading across and entering the satrapy of Armenia. Tiribazos and Antalcidas get together, and they come up with a document, which the king, Artaxerxes, endorses, that will take for Persia the role of arbiter among the Greeks. Now remember, this is all a Spartan scheme. It's a way of having the Persian king show up with the big stick to enforce peace and harmony among the Greeks. But in fact, it's so that the Spartans can go on operating without fear of Athenian naval reprisals. At any rate, in the winter of 387-386 BC, all the Greek city-states receive invitations from the great king, from Artaxerxes, to attend a conference in that city we have visited so often, the city of Sardis in the Old Kingdom of Lydia. They meet there, and they find that Antalcidas and Tiribazos have drafted this document. What does the document say? It seems good to the king that the Greek cities in Asia shall belong to the king as of old. That is, as of old before 480 and 479 BC, when the Athenian navy along with the other Greeks, liberated them from Xerxes. Second, all the other Greeks shall be autonomous and free. In other words, there shall be no more building up of empires among the Greeks. There shall be no Spartan Empire, no Athenian Empire, the only exceptions being that a couple of islands that the Athenians had come to view as their own, Lemnos and Skyros, these are stepping stones up to the Hellespont, the grain route that brings Athens its wheat from the Black Sea. These are thrown in for Athens, Athens property, as a little sop to Athenian pride, as a way to induce the Athenians to quit fighting and sign the peace. If anyone breaks this peace, the great king shall be the enforcer, and he will make war on those who violate the peace with ships and with money. A very funny way of describing making a war. Well, the Greeks were not enthusiastic about this, but they signed. And so in 386 BC, a new world order came into being for the Greeks, mandated by their hereditary enemy, the great king of Persia, who has now set himself up through this document as overlord of the Greek world. It's as if Athens and Sparta are bickering children who cannot stop fighting on the playground, and finally the teacher comes out, knocks their heads together, and says, "Behave." Artaxerxes was the schoolmaster for Greece, and when the delegates returned from that meeting back to their cities, lots and lots of ordinary Greeks were appalled to think that a century after beating Xerxes, defeating the Persians, showing that the Greeks were a greater fighting force than all of the massed armies and navies of Asia combined, it had come to this, that without the great king ever having to fight a great war or defeat them in any kind of decisive way, just because they couldn't unite, they had turned over to him the ability to rule them, to dictate to them. This may not seem so gigantic to us, but the fact is that that's what empires were in the ancient world, and I've made this point before, but let me make it again. The Roman Empire gives us a false impression of normalcy among empires. Usually it was a conquering people, a conquering dynasty, who took over chains and regions filled with city-states and brought them together and basically dictated their foreign policy to them and demanded tribute from them. That was all. There wasn't a tremendous amount of interference. There was no attempt to build Roman-style temples, Roman-style marketplaces, all the rest of it everywhere. Persians didn't behave that way. So for the king to dictate the foreign policies of Greek states was tantamount to saying, "You are now part of my empire, and I will keep the peace that you seem unable to keep yourselves." This created a reaction among the Greeks. They were now up against it. They really saw what their disunity and their disharmony had brought them to. And we might point out here that this seems endemic to city-state systems. City-states, what a Greek called a polis, and from that word we get politics, and politician, and political, and cosmopolitan, and Indianapolis, city of Indiana, all of these polis words. To the Greeks, that didn't just mean an urban area. That polis is a city-state, and that's why we have to use that cumbersome hyphenated term to duplicate it in English. It's a city and its surrounding territory. The territory feeds the people in the city with its farms and its produce, and the city defends those who are out in the countryside by giving them safe walls to hide behind in case of an invasion. There have been city-state systems in Sumeria, down there in southern Mesopotamia, what is today Iraq, those ancient cities like Ur and Uruk and Erech that show up in the Bible and in the ancient accounts of Gilgamesh, they couldn't get along. They were at war with one another all the time until Sargon of Akkad, world's first great emperor, unifier of city-states, welded them into one kingdom with a dictatorial central government. There were city-states in Maya country, in Mexico and surrounding modern nations like Guatemala, where these individual little ceremonial centers each supported a king, a court, an army, astronomers, grand public buildings, perpetual warfare, as we now know, since the Code of the Maya has been cracked by archaeologists, and we can read their records of continuing strife. The Renaissance in Italy was marked by competition between city-states. Venice, Padua, Pisa, Florence, fighting it out, irrepressibly unable to unite until finally outside conquerors come in and do the unification for them. So the Greeks are part of a system in which warfare simply seems endemic, systemic, part of the inevitable way of life that's engendered by city-states. What's the plus side? There's never been a system in human affairs that engendered more remarkable innovations, competition, free enterprise, entrepreneurship than city-states. So we're left with this unfortunate paradox that the system that seems to get humans the furthest, the fastest, seems to have warfare bred into its very bones. Where do you find stability? Where could ancient peoples look out and see stability? Egypt, never a place of city-states, always a unified kingdom around the Nile River. Look over at Mesopotamia, the empires of Asia. Once the city-states of Sumeria had been unified, then you get this world of the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, with single emperors, kings of kings, ruling over it, and stability because the individual city-states have been suppressed. And of course, when we get to Rome, we will have the same sort of thing. So this situation was the identifying character of Greek civilization, that character of being a city-state civilization. How did the Greeks expand? They'd start from one city-state, Athens, Megara, Corinth, and they'd send out colonies. And those colonies would land on a coast somewhere, Spain, France, Sicily, Italy, North Africa, the Black Sea, Asia Minor. And what would they create? A new city-state, independent of the mother city, sometimes fighting wars with the mother city. So this isn't an expansion, a colonial expansion, where you build empires typically from one city. It's just creating new cities on the model of the old ones in central Greece. This is what was sometimes called the wound of Greece, that this perpetual warfare seemed to be something they couldn't break out of. Now, there were certain things that drew the Greeks together. We've already talked about one of them, the oracle shrines, places like Delphi, places like Dodona, the oracle of Zeus up in the mountains of northern Greece. At these oracular shrines, the Greeks, who all worshiped the same gods, would come together and pray and give offerings and show their commonness, their Greekness, as they worshiped Apollo. There were also the big games. We're most familiar with the Olympic Games, which were held at Olympia in southern Greece. They were in honor of Zeus, but there were also Pythian games to Apollo, Isthmian games there under the pine trees at the Isthmus. Those were in honor of Poseidon. More games to Zeus at Nemea in the Peloponnese. Those are the four crown games, where instead of getting a cash prize, you're given a crown of wild leaves. That was all. You just competed for the honor of that crown. But Athens also sponsored a thing called the Panathenaic Games, to which all comers could come, and so on. So with these games, with these shrines and common sanctuaries, with their common language and their common sense of independence, freedom, personal worth, the Greeks were united culturally, but disunited politically. Now, after the king's peace was handed down by Artaxerxes in the 380s, an Olympic festival took place in 384 BC. And to that festival came an Athenian orator. He was actually a resident alien in Athens, but the status of those who came to Athens as resident aliens, it's a little like modern America. It was a place of opportunity for people in other cities whose economies were not so robust. They'd come to Athens and they would have chances to shine. This man's name was Lysias. He'd made a mark as the greatest orator in Athens, and ultimately he was so impressive, the city turned over to him after one of their wars against Sparta in the 390s, the right to give the public funeral oration for the heroes who'd fallen in that war. In 384 BC, Lysias traveled from Athens to the Olympics. Our modern Olympics are modeled on the ancient Greek Olympics, so they happened every 4 years, and they were always at Olympia. He went there because that was a pan-Hellenic place. You could count on meeting Greeks from all over the Greek world. And Lysias read out an oration because at the Olympic Games, it was not only the track and the field and the chariot races and so on, but it was a chance to hear people talk. You may remember Herodotus. Well, in addition to reciting his history of the Persian Wars in Athens, he'd also done it at Olympia, and people had heard him talk there. So they were used to hearing orators, and here was this Athenian, or this man from Athens, Lysias, who gave an appeal for Pan-Hellenism, that the Greeks should unite in a war against Persia. This speech was not the first on that theme. In the Olympics that followed that amazing Battle of Cyzicus, where Alcibiades led the Greek fleet, the Athenian fleet, against the Spartan fleet sponsored by Pharnabazos back in 409 BC, the very next Olympics, a speaker named Gorgias from Sicily had come to the Olympics to make the same plea. Sicily at that time was being attacked on the far side by Carthage, colonists of the Phoenicians, Asiatics, who were also trying to take over the Western Greek world, just as the Persians from the east seemed to be trying to take over the Central Greek world. So Gorgias had presented this idea, a generation later, Lysias, and then in 380 BC, the big publication was made of the thing that became the manifesto for Pan-Hellenism, an oration called the Panegyricus, the thing in praise of all kinds of things, by an Athenian named Isocrates. And I'd like to take a moment to tell you about this remarkable man, because this Pan-Hellenic dream is going to become linked especially to his name. He wrote oration after oration, letter after letter on this theme. It became his cause. He was a bit of a dreamer. He stayed outside of politics himself. And maybe in some ways this idea of the Greeks uniting was just a pipe dream. But he was so eloquent about it that he kept the dream alive for decades. He was 99 when he died, and he was still writing about this theme of Pan-Hellenic unity and what was going to make the Pan-Hellenic unity a common purpose: war on Persia. So Isocrates is our hero for this lecture. He's the great prophet of Pan-Hellenism. Let's get to know him a little bit. He was born in 436 BC. He was born into one of those rich manufacturing families of Athens, where their money came not from ancient ownership of land and noble rank, but just from hard work. His father owned a factory where they manufactured those pipes, those musical instruments that were played by the pipers at parties. They are often mistranslated in modern texts as flute girls, but they aren't flutes. They're much more like oboes. They're actually like the medieval instrument, a shawm. If you picture the chanter of a bagpipe, the thing that the piper holds in their hands and plays on, that's got a double reed in it that the pressure of the air forced through from the bag produces an incredibly strong, reedy sound that you can hear for miles. It's an outdoor instrument. They played it at the theater. They played it in the warships. The Spartans had their pipers accompany the men into battle to keep them in step. And this was a factory owned by Isocrates' father, manned by slaves who produced these pipes and the reeds that went in them. They lost all their money in the Peloponnesian War. Like many Athenian families, they were ruined by the conflict with Sparta. And so Isocrates, in his 30s, was suddenly thrown out on the world with no obvious means of making a living or supporting himself. He had been a pupil, like so many other important Athenians of that latter part of the 5th century BC, a pupil of Socrates, the philosopher. And in one of Plato's dialogues, Plato shows Socrates, his master, referring to this young Isocrates and saying, "I know he will make a great mark on the world, either in oratory or in philosophy." Philosophy didn't mean quite the same thing to an ancient Greek that it does to us, even though we derive our philosophy from the ancient Greeks. To the Greeks, it meant simply love of wisdom, which is what the compound word means, philosophia. Philos, love; sophia, wisdom. And so it could embrace all kinds of things. Natural sciences, the path that Aristotle is going to follow, abstract thought and reasoning about the virtues and the right way to live one's life, that's Plato's theme. All kinds of things are included in philosophia. But it was about thought, it was about the intellect. Oratory was putting philosophy to work by deciding the right course of action and making speeches to guide your fellow citizens in making right choices. In Athens, the place of oratory was a speaker's platform on that hill called the Pnyx, P-N-Y-X, the crowded place, where the 30 or 40,000 citizens would gather, or at least a quorum of them, about three times a month, and debate the issues confronting Athens in a sort of gigantic town meeting. Isocrates, with his oratorical gifts, his ability to craft a good speech, seemed marked out by nature to be one of those citizens who would have a tremendous impact on Athens, because he would stand on that platform in the open air, looking across on the one side to the Parthenon on the Acropolis, looking on the other side over to the sea, to the straits at Salamis, to the great naval installation at the Piraeus, and then out in front of him, all of his fellow citizens, waiting for him to talk, ready to cheer or jeer or express their own opinions immediately afterwards. But he couldn't do that. He had a very weak voice, he was very shy, and if people interrupted him, he was put off his stride. He couldn't engage in the back and forth that was expected of an effective orator in the political scene. So he put his philosophical interests together with his undoubted genius for crafting speeches, and he opened a school in which he taught others to make speeches. And they came to him from all over the Greek world. Timotheus, the son of Conon, he enrolled in Isocrates' school and loved his master and revered him. He brought Isocrates to the attention of people in Cyprus, Greeks in Cyprus, who had helped Conon and Timotheus when they were exiles. And so Isocrates built up around him an academy, a school for oratory and philosophy, the way that out at the grove of Academe, the academy, Plato, among the olive trees, was creating a school for those who wanted to inquire into abstract philosophy. And then out at the Lyceum, Aristotle was going to come along a generation later and create a school of those interested in politics, ethics, and natural science. This was the kind of transformation that made Athens into a university town, which endured long after the imperial Athens went under. Isocrates was part of that transformation. So he, at 56, he went to that Olympic festival of 380 BC, and he took with him the text of this gigantic work, the Panegyricus, and he probably distributed it as a pamphlet. It's possible that he had someone else stand up and stand on a stone there at Olympia and read it to the crowd. It's awfully long. It would have taken many, many hours to recite. What's his theme? His theme is, we are now disgraced, we Greeks, because of the king's peace. We are allowing the Persians to dictate to us. It's time for someone to come up with some good ideas. And he starts off by using the fact that he's at the Olympic festival to make a comment which is still relevant today in our sports crazy world. You know, he said, if you were to double the strength or the athletic ability of every athlete on earth, double it, you would do nothing to better mankind in general. It would have no impact whatever. But if you were to do the same for just one human being in terms of their intellect, their ability to perceive new ideas, you would benefit all of humanity who could share that insight. And I have to say that to stand up and say this at the Olympic Games, the holy shrine of athletic mania, took some guts, whether he had somebody else do it or just published his little pamphlet. He then goes on to make his concrete proposal. We must unify. What unifies people? A common purpose. What's the natural common purpose for Greeks? War on the barbarian, the Persian. That's the way it should be. That's what our tradition is. That was the only time we united in the past, was against the Persians. And we must do it again. And he has two reasons. First is the one I just said, unification. The other one is, let's get rich. The Greeks were very open about their desire to gain material advantages, gain wealth from warfare. We in the modern world are much more prissy about saying that that's a motive, but they were very upfront about it. We should be enriching ourselves through wars, not wars on each other, not Athenians taking from Spartans and Spartans taking from Thebans, but let's all get together and hit the biggest pile of wealth on earth. Now remember, he's just repeating here that argument of Aristagoras of Miletus way back in 499 BC when he showed up in Greece and tried to persuade first the Spartans and then the Athenians to participate in a grand war against Persia that would end in the capital city of Susa, way off beyond the Tigris River, 1,600 miles from the sea, and dump into the victorious Greeks' laps all the wealth of the treasury of the Persian Empire. Money, gold, wealth. This is something to make a Greek sit up and take notice. Now, how's this going to be done? Athens must lead. But the Spartans need to join in. They need to forget their differences. He spends a lot of the Panegyricus going over recent Greek history, showing the track records of the different states. And remember, in an age before you could go to libraries and pull down books off the shelves and read these histories and authoritative accounts, it was this kind of speech, whether it was a funeral speech praising the noble dead or a political speech like this one trying to promote a certain new course of action, that was where people got their history. And it's kind of amusing to us today to see that Isocrates, like other orators, you know, you'll kind of twist facts to make your point. So gradually the reality of what went on in the past, we can see getting a special spin on it in all these successions of orations, especially by Athenian speechmakers. There was one argument he made in particular. He accused the Persians of malakia, softness. Now, we spent a couple of sessions with Xenophon and his 10,000 going into and then fighting their way out of the Persian Empire. Isocrates mentioned this. He may have met Xenophon. He certainly could have at the Olympic Games because Xenophon, though an exile from Athens, lived very near Olympia. And he held this up as a shining example. The Persian Empire was so weak that with its millions, it still could not prevent 10,000 armed Greeks from going wherever they wished in the king's domain. There was a powerful argument. We will see in the future that Isocrates and the other orators exaggerated the malakia, the softness of the Persian Empire. But at this point, it still rang very true to his Greek listeners. Nonetheless, however much intellectual agreement the Panegyricus and Isocrates' other speeches on this theme may have won for him and for his idea, the Greeks just are not capable of this. They may rationally say this makes sense and this is the right course of action, but the on-the-ground political situation is every one of those cities is continually going to be vying with its nearest neighbor. So 30 years after that famous event, the Olympic Games, where he presented this to the world, the octogenarian Isocrates, and he helps us get over the idea that it's only in modern times that people have long, fruitful lifespans, he's still looking for some way to unify Greece. And it's at the end of his life, in the 350s, that he finds the person he thinks is a champion. I mentioned the fact that city-states continually fight each other. Kingdoms can be at peace and stable. On the north end of the Greek world, there was a kingdom called Macedon. You may remember back in the winter between the Salamis campaign and those final battles of 479 BC when Xerxes' forces were finally destroyed by the Greeks, a king named Alexander of Macedon came down to Athens and tried to bring the Athenians over to the Persian side because the Macedonians themselves had already bowed to the inevitable and surrendered to Xerxes. Well, now there was a successor of that King Alexander of long ago. That King Alexander, by the way, had been recognized as a Greek, although his kingdom was so far off to the north. And how was he recognized as a Greek? He was allowed to participate in the Olympic Games. That was the assurance that you are truly of Hellenic blood and descent because only Greeks were allowed at the Olympics, and that old King Alexander was welcomed at Olympia. His successor was the new strongman on the Greek scene. And old Isocrates from Athens sent him a letter begging him to take on himself the burden of unifying the Greeks and leading the Greeks on a great war of conquest into Persian territory, a war that would finally bring Aristagoras of Miletus' dream to reality, that the Greeks should conquer the Persians on their own land. The name of this king up there in Macedon was Philip. And it's certainly one of the coincidences of history that the man to whom this Panhellenist Isocrates looked to unify Greece and to lead the Greeks on a war into Persian territory was a man whose thoughts were going on exactly those same lines, though in ways that the Athenians and the Spartans, if they'd been able to look into the mind of Philip, would have frightened them into uniting against him. As it was, Philip took advantage of this friendly overture from this very influential Athenian, Isocrates, and began to lay his stratagems, his plans, his maneuvers to put the unification of Greece under himself as war leader, as hegemon, into action and make the attack on Persia a reality.